Accession number 31680, Reel 3.
Trimmers, mixture, fuel, flaps, gills, gyro. In other words, you adjust the trim of the aircraft, because on the edge of the elevators at the back are little subsidiary flaps that mean that if you don't have to sort of hold the stick back to keep it where you want it, it automatically is helped to be that, because of the leverage on the back of the elevator. And the same with you could do the same with the rudder. So you adjust the trim on aircraft, but they usually say if you put it in number 5, it's going to be all right for takeoff. You may adjust it when you're up in the air and so on. And otherwise, you just know what the controls are doing. You pull the stick that operates the ailerons. If you push it that way, you'll swing over. The aircraft will swing over that way. If you pull it back, it goes upwards. If you push it forward, go down. And the throttle operates the engine. And you would taxi out with your instructor, and he would go through the whole of the things that you have to do, like flying straight and level, doing turns to the left, turns to the right, descending and so on. Just really descending, gliding, turns, then takeoffs, really. I mean, the takeoffs and landings are the only tricky bits in any sort of flying. And it's usually the landing, the takeoffs, as long as you don't get an engine failure, are fairly straightforward, really. You just line it up, look around, there's nobody going to come in and over your head, just landing in front of you. Open the throttle gradually, not too quickly, otherwise you might get weaken the mixture and it might stall a bit. So you open it gradually, and then fully as you're running along, you pull off the ground, then you ease the stick a bit forward so you can pick up flying speed, flying parallel to the ground, but not into the ground again, and then until you reach a climbing speed, which is a little bit higher than your takeoff speed, and then you climb up at that. At 500 feet, you perhaps throttle back and don't strain the engine too much, and perhaps do a turn to the left to get up onto the circuit at 1,000 feet, go down the downwind leg, and then you look over your wing to the left until you see where the end of the runway is, and you think, yes, that's just going about to be okay, I better go a bit further before I turn in. And then you go through another drill of vital actions, which would be checking that you've got enough fuel to go round again if you aren't going to land, putting flaps down if you need so much flap, perhaps a third flap, and fuel flaps. Well, undercarriage, if you had an undercarriage let down, but a fixed undercarriage on the Tiger Moth. Look around, see there's nobody about, and turn in, and you see the runway coming up, or if it isn't a runway, a grass field, and you do a gliding turn in until you're just coming in over the hedges, and then you hold off, flare out, I suppose, and you hold off so that you don't fly into the ground, but so you don't balloon up. You just wait and wait and wait and wait, pulling your stick back. Airspeed drops, and sometimes you're drifting. That's one of the problems, so you then have to turn a bit into the wind to take off the drift, and then just before you're going to settle, you pull it straight and it drops down. You should be on the three-point landing. But I'm talking about something 60-something years ago. I did have a go when I was 70, and that's 15 years ago, and found I could still fly. I went with a Czech pilot at Bristol on a Cessna. It's like swimming, I think, if you're thrown in. So I suppose I've been tempted all my life to think, would I have rather been in flying, but I don't think that I would have been fully stretched. I think it would have been a bit like being a bus driver in the end, and I'd have had to get up at early hours in the morning to fly with people who have to go to Pisa or Rome at 5:30 or 7:30. I don't know that it would have been really there. I would have felt, I don't know whether you couldn't have done more than that. But a difficult decision, because I enjoyed it. Really.
How did you find the Tiger Moth as an aircraft to fly?
Well, I think it was really very, very easy to fly, really. I mean, it had various variants of it. The tiger moth, the fox moth had a little cabin and so on. But basically, it had a gypsy engine made by de Havilland's, I think, which was the cylinders were upside down. That was just to get the where the propeller is sort of high up on the fuselage, because you really bringing four things into account: the wherever the lift is from, the where the wings are, where the center of gravity is pulling you down, where the propeller's pushing you forward, the power, and the inertia's keeping you back. So all four have got to be sort of kept in fairly close to each other. Otherwise, when you've got your engine, it might all the nose might go up or vice versa. So they had this engine upside down, and that all it always seemed to work very well. The propeller had to be swung by a mechanic to bring it, to suck in the mixture into the cylinders, and then you put the switches on contact, pull it, and it should fire away. Later aircraft that I've flown, like the Chipmunk, which had flown in after the war in a reserve flying school, you had a cartridge-fired starter that called a Kaufman starter, that you got everything to the same point and pulled this, and there was a bang, and it threw it around for you. The great advantage was if you landed somewhere in some other airfield, or even in some field where you shouldn't have landed, but perhaps had to land, you could start off yourself, where you didn't have to have a mechanic to swing there. But you can't just get anybody, because they think they're going to get their arm knocked off if they're swinging a propeller.
Was there at this stage anything more advanced flying, gliding and aerobatics and stalls and that sort of thing?
Not really when I did that thing at Wolverhampton, but when I then went on the I think it was the Queen Elizabeth, the early Queen Elizabeth ship from the Clyde to Halifax, and then went out. you go through another dispatch centre at Moncton, New Brunswick. I went to Bowden in Alberta, which is north of Calgary, and there you did a whole series of things, and had to be checked on each one, you know, taxiing, stalling, descending turns, gliding, approach and landing, spinning. Now spinning can be a frightening sort of thing. What it really amounts to is you close the throttle but hold the stick back, so the engine is not pulling you forward, but the aircraft's forward speed begins to drop, and you reach the stalling point where the air over the wings is going so slowly that it's no longer lifting you, and it begins to fall, and at that point you kick full rudder on, and it then stalls but swings round and round in a slightly alarming and descending fashion. So you've got to do it above 3,000 feet, and the way to then get out of it is you put a stick forward and then the opposite rudder, and it'll gradually pull out, and then you put your engine on. If it didn't pull out, then you'd be the only thing would be to get out of the aircraft. But I don't think that ever happened. Although I was involved with seeing a chap spin into the ground, and I had to give evidence at a Canadian Air Force inquiry into what had happened to him. Really. So I went on to in Canada. I was still on Tiger Moth. So they had little covers over them, and they were known as the DH-82C instead of 82A, which was de Havilland Tiger Moth Canadian made. And they also had, when I first went there, skis instead of wheels, because it was snow everywhere, and you had to alight like a flipping something new to me. Like I said, I'd never done any skiing, land on the snow and whiz around. It was all possible, really. I remember, and then the aircraft were changed onto a thing called the Fairchild Cornell, which, I mean, they called their aircraft the training aircraft after great academic institutions like the Harvard, which was the most famous single-engined aircraft training. But the Cornell, called after the Cornell University, was was something I think the Americans evaluated and didn't like it too much. And so they, under Lend Lease, they gave it to the British Flying Training School. There were a number of, if one's honest about the Americans, who did help us in many ways, there were some aircraft that didn't match up. One was the Brewster Buffalo, not that I've ever flown it, that was used in Southeast Asia, particularly by Australians, I think, because it was too flipping dangerous or useless. And another one, the Chance Vought Corsair, which had a gull wing. I think the American Marine Corps used it, but in general they thought it was a bit too of a dangerous a thing, and so they gave it to the British Fleet Air. So I think there was a bit of, you know, well, we were giving them something for nothing or lending it to them. We don't have to give them the very best stuff. All right, I'm rambling on about this.
How did you find Canada itself?
Well, the Canadians were very hospitable. What do I remember about it? Well, one, it was the weather was terribly extreme in the summertime, because I was there for about 14 months, I suppose. We wore KD, called a khaki drill, shirts and slacks, I think. I don't think we wore bush jackets. No, I did that in India. But in the wintertime, you not only wore a greatcoat and a scarf, and you even wore a hat, which I'd never met before, called Caps Yukon, which had ear flaps and a big thing at the top front with a peak that went up, which had an Air Force badge on it, because you had to have something over your ears, otherwise you'd get frostbite. I mean, it was really desperately cold. So the weather conditions were different, but the Australians were very nice. I mean, I suppose the thing we first came across, the things we'd missed in England was ice cream and milk bars. You know, we used to go down to the local milk bar in Moncton and have Knickerbocker Glories, I think, they, you know, these long Sunday things, and play jukeboxes, which were full of Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and other people of that era. I didn't meet too much of Canadians when I was in, I think it was in Moose Jaw, on service aircraft at Oxford's. Another chap and I were, I don't know why we were selected, perhaps it wasn't that we spoke proper, but perhaps we looked as though we wouldn't set fire to the place. We were asked if we'd like to go to some family for the weekend, and I did go out to this, with this other character, to this family it was outside Calgary, I think, that one. And they were very hospitable, gave us nice food, and so they had a daughter. I don't know whether they were thinking any of us would get to know the daughter, but she was very nice. Well, we were passing through. I mean, I just remember reading books late at night. I remember reading Hemingway's book about Spain, for whom the bell tolls, in their house. But I wouldn't say I got to know the Canadians particularly well, not then at any rate. I've known, got to know Canadians since then.
Did you have much sense of their enthusiasm or otherwise for the war itself?
Yes, I think the Canadians were a pretty good lot. So were the Australians and New Zealanders, really. They volunteered in considerable numbers, particularly for flying, really. But the thing that used to amuse us was how the newspapers were all local newspapers. They don't think, there may have been in the Toronto Star and stuff, but it wasn't available in Moose Jaw. It would be the Moose Jaw or something or other. And this would cover, you know, Joe Bloggs has actually arrived in Europe. Perhaps he wouldn't even say the UK, and is engaged in this and the other. In other words, it was always about some local farm boy or something and what he was doing for the war effort. There wasn't anything much about whatever would have been going on at that time. There probably wasn't a great deal going on, because there was both it was past the phony war, but there'd be a lot of bomber command activity, and there might have been the beginnings of landings in North Africa, really, through Morocco and under Eisenhower. They wouldn't touch on things like that. It was all about the local chaps, really. But I know, as I've had this, some members of my family were in the newspaper business, and I remember one of them was an editor, said, they've only got to do two things. You've got to talk about the local people and what they're interested in, and you've got to get their facts right and their names right. If you do that, you're okay. If you miss out on any of that, you're in dead trouble. I suppose that's what the Canadian cities newspapers were like.
How much were you aware then of what was happening elsewhere in the war?
I should have been paying more attention, really. I don't know that I was too much aware of that. What did I used to read a magazine called Liberty, I think it was, which was rather like Picture Post, I suppose. It had bits in. I didn't read the local papers too much, apart from seeing they were very parochial. And I used to look at the coloured comics, particularly Mr. Al Capp about it's now politically incorrect to mention it. It's a sort of part of West Virginia called they called it Dog Patch, where Daisy May and her boyfriend lived. It was all kind of amusing stuff. And I suppose a lot of things coming out from shows that were on in New York that we thought we might get to see before we went home. I'm not sure I can remember the names of those. But it was more the sort of, well, some of the interesting cultural goings on, really. I went to one or two dances in, not with any success, I didn't really get to know anybody, in the local town near Bowdoin, north of Calgary, where some Air Force chap made a speech about it, which was quite amusing. And I think we did get to know just one or two people, on a very little knowledge, and they weren't seem to be more aware of what was going on in the war any more than we were, really. I think you just took it day by day to see how you were getting on in your ground school studies and your flying, really, and the various checks you had from time to time to assess how you were, which happened fairly frequently.
How much contact did you have with your parents?
Well, I used to write letters to them. There were things called... there was a sort of letter that was reduced by some photographic means, and they got a small copy with it all legible, but much smaller. I kept in touch with them. Perhaps every 2 or 3 weeks I would send something to them. I don't know how much they sent to me. I think they were able to send things to me. I thought they were an MPO, military post office number, so-and-so. Oh, that was quite good, really. I was aware that how they were getting on, really. then I did some navigational stuff and aerobatics here, steep turns. It's like steep turns because when you get the aircraft pulled onto its side, so that you're a bit over the 45 degree angle, if you pull your stick back, you go much more quickly around in a circle. In fact, it was like driving a motorcycle around one of these walls of death, really. You could. I liked it at the time. I don't know whether I'd like it now, really. I did instrument flying there and night flying. Oh yes, it says 45-hour check. Took 1 hour to do. Instrument flying. This is an awful lot of stuff. This is getting into 43. Precautionary landings. Above average, well, I seem to be doing okay. Oh, there was one chap that I always remember called Townsend who was the chief flying instructor. And I arrived late because on the on the train going across, I developed swellings in my glands, and they thought I had mumps. So they put me into an isolation hospital in Montreal for about a fortnight, and then I arrived, you know, after the other 30 or so people had arrived.
So it was
I got off in Montreal, and I was going to Bowden, which is north of Calgary, between Calgary and Edmonton in Alberta. And so I arrived a bit late. And so when I had to report to see the chief flying officer instructor, and he gave me the sort of speech that I think he'd made to a large audience, but I always remember one bit of it. He said, "No, I want to tell you something." An Englishman, he said, "I want to tell you something. The German nation is spending so many million Deutschmarks in Poland training air crew to the very highest standards. Why do you think they're doing that?" I thought it was fairly obvious. I said, "Oh, I don't know." He said, "I'll tell you why. To kill you," he said, pointing it at me. Obviously, then the same speech to hundreds. And I thought, he said, "No, there's only one way to get out of this. You've got to work harder, study harder, fly harder, get better, keep fit, better than they're doing." And so I said, "What do you think of that?" "Yes, sir," I said, getting out of the place as quickly as I could. And it was a riveting thought. So I went. I then went to Moose Jaw in Saskatchewan, onto Airspeed Oxfords. Some people went on to Harvard's at Calgary, and I went on twin-engined aircraft and did quite a lot of flying there.
How did you find the Oxfords to fly?
Well, the Oxford was a really tricky aircraft to fly, but because they were all rather... I was running through Canada in 43, after they'd been in use for quite a long time, particularly these ones, which, because the Moose Jaw was a transferred RAF school that came from Turnhill in Shropshire, or Staffordshire, en masse. And it was like a bit of England in the middle of Canada. If you were on a Canadian air station, which I was, you had waffles and orange juice and so on. At this transferred place, you had porridge and a mug of cocoa as though it was the UK. And everything was still just like a bit of England, and the discipline and this kind of unnecessary, we didn't call it bullshine, but something worse, was really remarkable. You walked everywhere, your hands up like this. You had a parade every week that... led by a chap with a dog and huge white gauntlets, and the band played the Air Force March. Well, I suppose it all did something to somebody, but I did think it was all a bit bizarre in a way. At any rate, the ones we were having, what I was saying was they needed a bit of servicing, and many of them had new engines and so on, some of which didn't work all that that well. But the main problem was that as soon as you landed, the vortices, or the air coming from the two air screws, as you slowed down along the runway and dropped to about 50 miles an hour or so, it somehow affected the tailplane, and the thing would shoot off to the right. And the only way to get over this that I eventually discovered was to put full rudder on. You had a brake, and press the brake, and perhaps open this other engine to counteract this. So they were a diabolical aircraft to fly in a way. And people said, if you can fly those, I mean, compared to the Anson, which was this gentle, really old thing, and nothing would go wrong, the Oxford was a bit of a bastard, really. But later, when I came back to this country, I went on to Oxford's at Little Rissington on a thing called a Pilot's Advanced Flying Unit. And they were much better maintained, so it probably was, and they were newer, so probably it was just they were a lot of old, you know, they'd had a lot of thrashing around and been sort of landed fairly heavily by some of my predecessors, I would have thought. I ought to get on with other things, shouldn't I? I'm not getting on too well.
You knew at this stage, did you, that you'd be flying multi-engine aircraft?
Well, I knew once I went to Moose Jaw that I would be going to multi-engine, yes.
Was there any degree of say in that, that from your part of it?
No, I don't think so. I think I somehow thought I was that sort of type, really. I think I felt that I would... I wasn't a sort of whiz kid. Well, my aerobatics would have been all right, but I wasn't, because I used to be doing some things quite well. But I imagined that I would... Well, I think I would have thought I would be going under bomber command, really, and I rather accepted this. And also, I was sufficiently aware of the war that, to know that the Battle of Britain was over, and that it was probably going to be more of a... Bomber Command was going to be coming into its own more. And then from there, when I graduated, well, I found that, to my amazement, that I was top of the course just in, I think, because of my ground school subjects. You did ground school in the afternoon, flying in the morning 1 week. The following week, you switched over, and another flight or something did. So it was, and there were four flights with different hangars, and I think there were two squadrons. They alternated like this, but by the time you got through all the ground school and the flying, I think I knew by then that I was likely to be on a multi-engine aircraft. So I came out top of the course, and to my amazement, two or three of us were posted, without our asking for it, to this JR school, which is General Reconnaissance School at Prince Edward Island. Number one, JRS, PEI. And that meant you were going to go in coastal command. And they must have said, we want people who don't can fly well, but can also take in more, because you're going to have to learn a lot more. You had to, first of all, learn ship recognition, how to recognize not only the Scharnhorst and the Eisenhower, but a whole lot of Japanese ships with funny derricks on the back and different numbers of funnels and things. So I suppose they were just saying, we better have people who can cope with a bit more. But there was also, they did astro navigation, which I never really had to use, but using the stars and sextants and so on. And that went on. That was in the winter, December, January 43. And it was from there. I must have only done 36 hours there. But I did a number of... Well, with another chap, we had to do the navigation while a staff pilot flew us around from Prince Edward Island up to the entrance to the St. Lawrence River. It's called the Gaspé Peninsula, a bit of Nova Scotia that sticks out at that point. And down to over various harbours like Halifax and St. John, New Brunswick, where you had to recognise the shipping and make notes of where it was, which dock it was in, and come back. And they were marked on all this. It was fairly, they were on the ball, really.